This is the Razor Update for June 26, 2016. I'm Phil Padilla.
I'm Patrick Methlin.
I'm Brandon Perkins.
I'm Chris Sologi.
And I'm Lee Lamb.
And guys, it's definitely summer now.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've noticed, but it's like really fucking hot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think for me, like, that has actually affected my gaming somewhat, because, I don't really like playing games when I'm sitting in a puddle. It's not really all that fun.
I'll tell you this. I'm happy that my office/media room is in the basement.
Yeah.
Because it's been so damn hot here. Like, I'm sweating right now because I just came in from outside, but I literally, like, what was it, last night, it topped out at, like, 100. It was 99 or 100 here. And, like, I swear to God, I went upstairs and my thermostat said, really, dude? Really?
Seriously?
So, and it, to be fair, it kept it at about, like, I think it was, like, 79 degrees, so I was happy.
Yeah.
But all I can think about is I'm going to have to get my AC replaced. This is going to be the summer that kills it.
Yeah.
Georgia heat ain't no joke, yo. It's... Yeah. It will murder a lesser man.
Yeah,
believe me.
And air conditionings.
Yeah,
yeah.
You remember that part in the Brave Little Toaster with the AC unit?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of like that.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't know about you guys, but I haven't been playing a lot. But I have been playing The Sequence because it's a game I can kind of just play without putting a lot of motion into, basically just use my brain. I also started Lost Sea. I can't really say too much about that because I haven't gotten too far into it, but it's like a kind of action RPG set on with a castaway type theme. Yeah, it seems pretty cool so far. We'll have to put some more time into it to really figure it out, but I like what I'm seeing so far. It's got a nice art style. It's kind of cutesy, kind of stylized. Seems pretty cool. But I'll have to follow up on that, see if it actually holds up. But beyond that, how about you, Brandon?
Well, I mean, Pat's going, isn't he?
He's got nothing.
Yeah.
Pat makes sense.
Yeah.
Brad's like, no, I'm good. I don't have the heat.
Technically, I've got heat's been a problem here too. It's just been about staying inside all day with the AC cranked up.
Yeah.
Central air is a beautiful thing.
I feel like maybe that's like the game that's like resource management. Like, how hard can I push my AC unit before it revolts?
Well, considering that Cache Valley is a desert at high altitude.
Yeah,
we get the worst of everything.
Yeah. So basically, you've just been playing MTG, and that's about it.
Yeah, more or less. Went to a Street Fighter tournament.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right. Well, as for me, first thing I've been playing is Vampire the Masquerade Bloodlines, which is it's an oldie but a goodie.
Yeah.
About 12 years old, I think. It came out in 2004.
Yeah.
It's from Troika, so it's, an old school RPG publisher. Yeah. So if you do that, you know what you're getting into. There's basically a button for everything.
Yeah.
Cuz just simple mouse click is apparently too easy.
Yeah.
You can't just go up to something and just right click and take it. No, you got to press E, and then you got to go into your inventory and then all this bullshit. Mm. That being said, however, it still holds up really well. Mm. In spite of the obvious graphic, the obvious primitive graphics. Which actually aren't that bad, to be honest.
It's a Source Engine game, isn't it?
Yeah.
Can't be that bad.
It takes place, of course, in the World of Darkness, which, if you're an old-school White Wolf gamer, you know what the World of Darkness is. Mm-hmm.
Downtown Atlanta?
Yeah. There's actually a lot of Vampire the Masquerade people in Atlanta. So.
I was gonna say, is it south of the airport?
Probably.
Nightclub over there somewhere.
Basically what it is that, you know, you're a recently sired vampire. And, you know, because the thing about being a vampire in Vampire the Masquerade is that they have this whole system called the Masquerade where they're basically doing they have a code that they live by to make sure that nobody realizes that vampires actually exist. In fact, they actively put out misinformation, not only about the existence of vampires, but how to actually kill them. So, you know, crucifixes, no, garlic doesn't work. Stakes only in the heart, and it just stuns you for a while. And of course, the only real part, of course, is the sun. But and so, basically, what happens is the guy who basically, or girl, depending on what type of character you end up choosing, is basically executed because he basically sired you without approval from the council. So
kind of like China, what they do with their kids.
Yeah.
But that's actually like sort of like half a joke. Like they had the stuff where you couldn't have more than one child.
Yeah, they actually
with the government.
Yeah, they actually fixed that, so now it's a two-child only policy. Specifically, it's because they're trying to get more girls.
Too bad it does not apply to vampires.
So basically, once that happens, they decide, all right, we're going to let you live, but we need to get you a mentor. And so that happens. And so what ends up happening is that you're sort of learning the ropes of how to be a vampire. And what I actually love about this game compared to like a lot of other games involving vampires is, you know, at least until Don't Nod comes out with Vampire, is that it's actually a pretty actually a kind of a realistic idea of what I would expect life as a vampire is, because a good chunk of the game involves you having to actively find prey and drain them. You know, you have to feed. You know, that's how you get your energy back and a lot of your health. But the thing is, there's actually a rule in the Masquerade that says that you can feed, but you can't completely drain them so that they die.
Yeah.
Because that actually breaks the code. And if you do that if you break the code too many times, eventually they start sending the enforcers after you. And those guys are like ultra mage powered.
Yeah.
And then if you do it too many times, your game just ends. So, you know, there's that. I'm also still playing Divinity Original Sin and Overwatch as well. So, what about you, Chris?
So this morning, I decided to take a trip to Best Buy to check out the PlayStation VR demo that they're supposed to be doing. They have a big site for it and all that. You just put in your zip code and it tells you which stores are doing it. And their schedule, so it said 11:30 to 4:30. So I was like, well, I'll get there at 11:30. Hopefully get in and out quickly. And I get there, there's nothing. There's three people standing, like they're kind of in a line. Like, oh, I'm not going to stand there. I don't even see anybody like setting up anything. So I go and hang out around in the game department, just look at stuff. And keep an eye on them, see if anything happens. Nothing. I end up going over to the DVD, Blu-ray area, just so I'm not like the weirdo that's looking at the same games for 30 minutes. And I guess it's past 12 o'clock, and I'm like, well, there's nothing here. They're still standing over there like idiots. I'm going to go, so... I made sure beforehand that I had a backup plan at Best Buy, a reason to go. So I picked up my purchase of Fallout 4 for the PC for $20, which is cheaper than a Steam sale. So I was like, I'll get that and save myself some money. Figure that'll be decent backup plan for this in case nothing happens. So, yeah, nothing happened.
Yeah, it's like they couldn't be bothered to show up, apparently.
And no sign of anything like there was going to be somebody there.
Yeah.
I've seen people actually posting things about their experience at various other demo stations around the country. So I know they're still doing it. Just for whatever reason, despite it saying this is going to be like a 4 or 5 hour thing here, nothing was there that I could tell.
Yeah.
I didn't want to stand there for a few hours just waiting. It's like, I got better things to do than waiting at Best Buy doing nothing.
Yeah.
I picked up Stardew Valley at the Steam Summer Sale. And that one's 20% off, so it was about $12. And that's a hell of a game. So Stardew Valley is essentially a Harvest Moon clone. So it goes further than that. There's essentially a cave you can go into that's sort of a series of dungeons. You go and mine for minerals and such that you're not going to get outside of there and take on some enemies with your sword. So far I've played maybe about 10 or so in-game days, which is probably about 3 hours at this point. I even was playing it before I went to Best Buy, and it saves at the beginning of every day, so every time I would get close to the end of the day, I looked over the clock. It's like, okay, I got enough time for one more day. It's like one of those sort of civilization games.
Yeah.
Where it's like one more day, because I can go get my plants taken care of, and then I can go clean out the farm, because when you get to the farm, there is a bunch of wood and rock and grass that you got to get rid of just so you can sort of expand your farm. And it's like a mix of Animal Crossing, Harvest Moon, and like a Zelda a little bit. So there's constantly stuff to do. Constantly I'm looking like, okay, I'm good at these geodes. I need to take it over to the blacksmith because he can break them open. And I can take these gems inside over to the library because it's sort of like Animal Crossing. It, you have like the owl you take all your unique stuff to. This thing you can go take your unique like gems or whatever is in the geode and they'll put it on display. And you can learn a little bit more about what they are. You can go fishing, collect fish, sell that stuff. Occasionally get quests like, oh, this person wants a sunfish, and I went and got him a sunfish, and there's the whole relationship thing where there's like 10 hearts to fill up, so like doing quests for people fills up a heart. You can give them gifts. There's just a lot of stuff to this game. Very much one of those games that it's probably a good idea to keep a wiki open just in case you're, well, you know, where the hell am I going to get a sunfish at? It's like, oh, it's in this river. But if I go out to the ocean, it's like, I mostly get sardines. Weird stuff like that.
Yeah, it seems like something that's really fleshed out for an indie game.
Yeah, very much. It was made by one guy. It took him about 4 years to make it. And it's a great game. Looking forward to playing more of this. And definitely one of those games you go like, oh, I'm going to play for a little bit. And then 4 hours later, like, well, damn, there goes all that time. and it's going to be coming out to the consoles later this year, so definitely, if all that stuff sounds cool, definitely check it out. Sort of in addition to that, as far as games you can't put down, I started up Civilization Revolution 2 Plus on the Vita, which is one of the games in sale on the PSN Flash sale. We'll be talking about in a little bit. So this is a port of the iOS Android version as the only versions that are out there.
Okay.
It's very similar to the original game. Definitely because they made it on a phone, there's a little less presentation to it. You just sort of go into it and it's like, I want to start a new game. Here's the leader I want. And let's go. So just having played Civilization 5 for a little bit and Revolution a bunch, I already knew what I was doing, so I just skipped the tutorial and all that. Still really good. Has a little bit of a couple issues. The controls aren't always as responsive as I'd like, since you can use buttons. Occasional times where I go to try to tell my unit to go over to this space, it hit X and nothing. Hit X a couple more times, maybe eventually registers one of them. Sometimes I just get fed up and just tap the spot, and it's like, oh, want to go there. Okay. It's like, you guys put button controls in this, make sure they work well.
Yeah.
And still getting used to the controls, just because it's have a mix of touch and button controls for some of the stuff. There's occasional times where I get some units, I get kind of forget that they're in sort of a defensive stance. Like if I have a galley going around with some guys in there, it's like one that's so weak I don't even bother bringing them out, so I just leave them in there in defensive stance and try to get my guys out to where they're going. And when they finish exploring, I try and bring them back in. Sometimes just forget to move the boat because it's also in defensive stance. So it skips over it when I go to try to get all my troops doing stuff. Some weird stuff like that. There's one point where the Russians were on the same continent as me when I started. And their guy, I was trying to go around this mountain range, and they had a guy just standing on the other side of the mountain range, so I couldn't actually get through him. I just wouldn't move. I waited a turn, waited a turn. Nothing. I go, oh, fuck, I'm going to declare war and you kill you so I can get through. I was like, oh, peace, peace afterwards. Like, man.
Out of my way.
If your stupid idiot guy would be able to move. Like, one thing is like, hey,
if
we're
isn't solving all of your problems, you aren't using enough of it.
Yeah. Like, we're supposed to be peaceful, but your guy can't just say, excuse me, let me get through. Also weird stuff like can't walk through friendly territory.
Yeah.
Sort of like, hey, there's this other route around the mountain. Like, if I try to point the spot to the other side of the guy that I want to get to, it'll say, maybe you go around this way. And it's like, it goes and it gets stuck on the enemy territory. It's like, why'd you tell me I could go this way if you don't?
Yeah.
It's like weird stuff like that, but other than that, it's still really good. It's $8. XCOM is also $8 on there as well, so I'm probably going to pick that up in a little bit. Yeah, that's been mainly it. So how about you, Lee?
Doing the usual. I have been doing WoW. We just got to, we really have two more kills to do, and then we're done with heroic raiding, so I'm really excited about that. Doing it at the tail end of the expansion, which is kind of funny, but, you know, it is what it is. So doing that, and I've been trying to creep through Fire Emblem Awakening, and just... The combat is still fun. I'm still having a good time with it. But like one of the things that's apparent to me is that the difficulty in that game is, I don't want to, it's not bullshit because I haven't lost. I've come close to losing some people and stuff like that. But like, and it definitely makes you, you know, it focuses on trying to get you to play smart. And that's great. But it's, it feels like they know, or they knew that sort of the double up mechanic was so strong that they'll give you five guys and you'll be fighting off 45 enemies. And
successfully.
So, what's that?
Successfully.
Yeah. And so it's just been one of those things where I'm like, well, this is cool, but it sort of feels like they didn't know really how to deal with the difficulty or with the units being powerful. So it was just like, you know, let's just Zerg you to death. and again, I mean, I guess that's fine. Like I don't really ever hit a point where I'm like, oh, well, I'm getting my ass kicked or something. Like I don't end up like that, but there's just, I don't know. There's something about it where it just kind of has me like, eh. And the story hasn't really gone anywhere. I got to like chapter 15, which is where, you know, some stuff pops off, I guess. Like, you know, some people reveal themselves, and I don't want to say anything as far as spoilers, but
It's been a long time since I played. Is that the new story arc?
I don't know. I don't know how you would even describe it. It's like, well, who here hasn't played it?
I haven't.
Okay. All right. Well, there comes a point where, like, you know, at the beginning of the game, there's a mysterious character, right? And then at the end, not at the end, but the point that I'm at, you figure out who that mysterious character is. And it's getting into just like some shenanigans.
New story.
And the way that people are responding to it is so like unrealistic, I guess, that I'm just, it kind of pulls me out of it. So like I felt like the story was pretty strong kind of up until now. And it's sort of like kind of meandering around. But from what I hear, there's only like 28 chapters. I think I'm on 16. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to try and power through it. But it is one of those things that's kind of giving me pause where it's just like, you know, just because my gaming time is so limited, because even like with raiding with WoW, I do it, I think, for like 4 total hours a week. So it's not like WoW takes up a ton of my time. So when I have the time for another game, like whether it's at night, you know, or during, you know, during the afternoon when the family's doing something or whatever, I want to be able to make like meaningful progress. And the story so far in Awakening, even though, again, the combat is super fun, it's enjoyable. It's enjoyable watching everybody battle. I've even gotten used to the fact that people don't have feet. But
that takes some doing.
It does take some doing. But I'm kind of like, I'm losing interest fast simply because the story isn't going anywhere. It, at this point, seems almost nonsensical. And frankly, in a lot of ways, the parallel I could draw to it is kind of, in a way, is kind of Game of Thrones. Because in Game of Thrones, for anybody that's watched the show or read the books, at the very beginning, you get introduced to the White Walkers, and then you really just don't fucking hear about them, right? And, like, Fire Emblem sort of does the same thing. Like, the beginning of the game starts with, like, these zombies hopping out of a portal. They're called Risen, and everybody's like, oh, shit, like, zombies. Like, this is not good. And then, like, the point that I'm at in the story, everybody's like, was there zombies? It's not that we should worry about. Yeah, there was like, they used to be like everywhere.
This is kind of something that's going on in the background of this,
this
story.
Mm-hmm. And there's a point where like there's a time skip. It's like 2 years later. And I'm like, what? Mm-hmm. Wait, where are the zombies? You don't just do 2 years when there's zombies. That's not how this works. and so that's kind of where it started to lose me. So like I said, I'm gonna try and power through it. I hope it picks up. But
one thing I will say is that as you're trying to find the least spoilery way to put this, as your character partnerships rank up, you'll soon find that your mysterious character did not arrive alone.
Oh yeah, I've gotten to that part too, and I'm like, okay. But the thing is like their attitudes about it is incredible. Like, so you're somebody. Oh, well, that's cool, I guess. Yeah, what's up? Like, it doesn't. I don't know, man. It doesn't work for me, and I'm just kind of like, all right, well, you know. But and I also just like, but the other part of it too is the a lot of the dialogue, like just the stuff like where you do a battle. And then you see the dialogue afterwards because you've had characters paired up and, you know, they have relationships. That stuff is really super fun to listen to and to see, but it's also not enough for me to kind of propel the game forward. I really had the same issue with Persona, like with Persona 4. Like, I want to see the story. I want to do this. But after I've gone through this, you know, the same dungeon essentially 7 times, like that loop isn't doing anything for me anymore. Yeah. And so I feel like I'm kind of getting there with Fire Emblem. I know that you can do a lot of class changing, and then when you get people married, they can produce different offspring that do different things. But it doesn't really feel like, even with any of that, that it has really varied the gameplay, I guess, enough that it's still able to get my attention. And, you know, the hook of finding out, you know, who some of these people are, and that's not really interesting to me either. So, I don't know. I'll see. I'm gonna power through it. And but yeah, other than that, I'm planning on knocking that out. I'm hoping Fates is better, at least as far as the storyline goes. Like, but I don't know. I found a thread actually on NeoGAF. It's like short games, and I was like, this is right up my alley. Like, Because I've been playing Fire Emblem for like 4 months.
Yeah.
So.
No, the only knock I can make on Fire Emblem Fates is just prepare yourself for DLC hell. Yeah. But it's the good kind and the bad kind because you do get the other versions of the game at a markdown.
Yeah, no, and that's cool. I mean, and even the thing with Awakening, like Awakening actually has cool DLC, but it's just, I think probably part of the problem too for me, the reason that I haven't sort of like, it's kind of pulled me back compared to the other Fire Emblems, because I beat the hell out of the other Fire Emblems, the ones that came on the GBA. Mm-hmm. I think it's a lot of it has to do with the fact too that there's, this sort of feels like an outlier. Like there's no, in other Fire Emblems, you know, you were successful and there were rewards if you blitzed people. Like in this one, like I got into a map where I was basically put into a pincer attack where I was surrounded on two sides.
Mm-hmm.
And in another Fire Emblem game, you would want to split your characters up, move one to the left, or move a couple to the left, move a couple to the right. I just sat in the middle. Like, come to me. I'm going to pair everybody up. Everybody's going to counterattack. You might hit me. I'll heal myself, and then I'll kill you. And that's not very fun, you know?
Am I the only one who's waiting for the day that Sega brings back Shining Force and shines a giant, just white-hot spotlight on all of the bad habits that Fire Emblem gives people?
Well, see, I don't even know if it's so much that. Like, I mean, I think there's a place for the way that this game plays. But, yeah. Like, as far as I can tell, and then from the stuff that I read about Fates, is that, you know, a lot of the stuff in Awakening is almost like an outlier. Like, the rest of, like, Fates doesn't work that way. But, I mean, it's difficult for me, like, just the way that I am. If I find a way that's sort of the path of least resistance, yeah, it's difficult for me not to take that. And that just comes from like playing fighting games. Like, yeah, I'll never forget. Way. Yeah. I never forget. Do you guys remember the original Splinter Cell?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So
yeah.
I got that on the Xbox, right? Back when it came out, and you know, they had the whole footstep system and they can hear you and stuff like that. Well, I realized about 2 hours into the game when I was trying to sneak up on somebody, I was tapping up on the analog stick and then letting it go like every half a second or so, just because I couldn't inch forward in the way that I wanted to. So I did that, and I realized that by doing that and then returning the stick to neutral, it stopped Sam Fisher's animation. So that meant that his foot never hit the ground, which then meant that you could sneak up on anyone. And so I just – and because, again, once I know how to do that, I can't play any other way.
Yeah,
it was like, oh, I killed everybody. I had a perfect run in that game. I never had any problems. I never had any situations where it was like, is this guy around the corner? Because you'd see my guy stutter stepping all the way across the level, and it's kind of like that with Fire Emblem, where I'm like, okay, I'm just gonna pair everybody up and put the healer in the center, and you guys are not gonna win. So yeah, so that's what I've been doing.
All I was really getting at is that if that ever happened, then I could pretty much go all day watching YouTube videos of Fire Emblem players going into Shining Force games and making the mistake of bunching up.
Yeah, you don't do that.
In Shining Force.
No, the majority of games that are like this, that bunching up is the exact opposite of what you need to do.
Yeah.
You need to be mobile. You need to have the ability to move around. Like, Awakening rewards the fact that you don't have to.
Hmm.
So and it's not it really doesn't do that at the beginning, but once you start getting your characters beefy, I mean, then that's all she wrote. If your character can take a hit or two, whether even one of your weaker ones, there is no challenge. You're going to murder everything because Krom and the main character get so overpowered. You just pair up a weak unit with them.
It handles it a lot better.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Because you just put a weak unit with them. Let them get smacked, uncouple, and beat the shit out of whoever's in front of you. So
Fates is a lot more self-aware. They've had time to really sit down and kind of ponder on their own new battle system.
Yeah.
And so,
well, but, yeah, you know, as much as I'm saying this, I mean, Awakening obviously did something that was good enough for a lot of people that we ended up with Fates, and you know, Fire Emblem seems to finally have a healthy fan base. I really think it was the casual mode where if even if somebody dies, you don't lose them.
Well, half the players were just resetting every time somebody died anyway. So
yeah, exactly. So, yeah. And I still think that was a brilliant move, especially, like, I don't think the version of me that I am now, I don't think I'd play an old school Fire Emblem where there was permadeath. I would just be like, fuck this. Yeah. So,
yeah.
Which is why I think they need to go back and remake a lot of all those with – remake a lot of the Fire Emblem games with the advancements that Awakening and Fates made.
I've played Awakening and I've played Fates, and I have never played Classic on either one of them.
That would be a hard move to make.
Yeah. I can't do it. I feel guilty afterwards.
Dude, for me, it's just it's a time investment thing. And if I'm going through a battle that takes 45 minutes and then one small mistake means that I have to reset it, I'm just not going to play. Yeah. Like, so them – and I didn't used to be that way. I was Mr. Let me put it on the hardest difficulty. I'm going to beat the shit out of this game. This game's not going to do anything. Like, you know, we're talking about, you know, Dante Must Die mode, shit like that. Like, that was what I would do. But that's just not me anymore. Like, the only challenge I get is doing, like, Heroic and Mythic raiding and WoW. And that's 4 hours a week. That's all I want. You know, for the other stuff, gaming is more relaxation now for me than anything else. So having a game that is just stupefyingly frustrating, it just doesn't do it for me anymore. And Pat's right. That's how people that were playing this stuff, like hardcore, they were just resetting it anyway. So,
But yeah, Lee, if they went back and made a dual pack of Mystery of the Emblem and Genealogy of the Holy War tuned up with all the enhancements from Awakening and Fates, how fast would we all buy it?
Oh, we totally would. Yeah, and that's the thing. I mean, I'm hoping, you know, whatever Nintendo does in the future, I mean, they realize there's now a cachet for this. There are people that do want this. And, that, you know, regardless of how I feel about Awakening, it's still incredibly well made. And it's still fun to play. So, yeah, I think it'd be – and especially, I guess, I'm hanging on to it now because I know as long as Fire Emblem is successful, I'm not getting any more Advance Wars. But then, like, I look at Advance Wars now as, like, a 35-year-old. Whereas I played it when it came out and I was like 20, I was like, oh yeah, this cool guy, this kid, this like 14-year-old running a tank battalion. Cool, whatever. I'm down with that. And now I'm like, wait a minute, this 14-year-old is a murder machine. Like, no, this doesn't work. There are people in those buildings, asshole.
All right.
I have fury.
Yeah. Oh, look at that. He activated his special attack. Starve me out.
These army generals with their superpowers
and backwards baseball caps.
Yeah. So yeah, I guess we'll move on from that and to a couple of ways to spend your money this week. PSN's got a flash sale going on. Anything stand out to you guys on that one?
The Vita actually has quite a few things on here. As I said earlier, Civilization Revolution 2 Plus and XCOM Enemy Unknown Plus are both $8. Some good prices there. Zero Escape Virtue's Last Reward, $7.49. Telltale has a bunch of their series on sale. The Wolf Among Us, Walking Dead Season 2, Tales from the Borderlands, and Game of Thrones for some good prices. Muramasa Rebirth, $7.49. PS4, there's actually Batman Arkham Knight.
That's what I was saying. Yeah, Batman Arkham Knight, I think it's like 10 or 12. And that's, even with some of the issues that game has, depending on who you are, like whether or not you like the Batmobile stuff, 12 bucks is a steal. That game is great.
Yeah.
Yeah, they also got Mad Max 16. Pretty good price for that. Let me see. You also get the older Batman games, Arkham Asylum and Arkham City, for like $5 or $6.
Yeah, and PS3.
Yeah. Guilty Gear, Xrd, Sign, it's on there. Also Blaze Blue, Chrono Fantastic.
The warning about the Guilty Gear and Blaze Blue versions is the Guilty Gear version that's on the sale is a version old, and the Blaze Blue version is about to be.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. You can also get the Back to the Future, the game. Great, it's on PS4 as well. So, yeah, some good stuff there.
it's tough. But it is like the summer flash sale. It's not one of the big. It's not the big one that they do like Black Friday and stuff. There's also the Steam summer sale going on, and it's like
save us all.
Yeah, there's like just way too much stuff in there to like really go over, because it's like 12,000 some games for sale. And we'll just go through all of them here right now. No, we're not going to do that.
Yeah, that's the problem, is you can't even actually see all of them.
Yeah.
it just surfaces stuff. Say, hey, this is on sale. It's like, was that all? It's like, nope. Yeah. Go find the rest. Go fuck off. Yeah, go through your wish list thing.
Yeah, that's what they're doing with the wish list. You go through it, and it's like, yeah, if they go, at least you can get some cards by doing that. So
yeah.
I will point out that the Sequence, the game that I've been playing a lot, is 50 cents. So, yeah, go ahead and pick that up.
Yeah, Talos Principle is 10 bucks. Just looking at the front page.
I don't really feel like there's anything that's on sale that hasn't been on sale for the last 3 years for the same price. Like, with the exception of stuff like you know, like we were talking a few minutes ago, like before the show started, like Witcher 3 you can get for like 25, but... I mean, really, like, everything that I guess I'm just not the typical person that does Steam, but everything that I've seen on sale, I saw on sale at Christmas, I saw on sale last summer, I saw on sale in January. Like, it seems to just be all the same stuff, you know, from the end of the last generation up until now. Like, we're talking, like, Fez, Hotline Miami, you know, all that stuff. Like, it doesn't seem like anything really new is on sale to me. I mean, of course, that's all probably just my perception, but...
Yeah. Well, Doom is on sale.
Yeah, Doom. Well, yeah, but I mean, just think about, like, the ratio of old to new is very skewed.
Yeah.
Yeah, because all the newest games aren't generally going to be on sale or sale for very much.
Yeah.
That's sort of the thing, is it's best at when you're saying, well, I'm going to keep an eye on this for later. I'll pick it up one of the big sales, because they'll probably put it on sale for better prices during those than just like this random middle of the week thing.
Yeah. So yeah, go check those out. Again, the Sequence is 50 cents, so yeah. Get that if you like games that stretch your brain.
Good,
that's a good one. Let's see what else we got going on here.
So it's Shark Week, guys. Did you know that? Yeah, PSN told me that.
We probably got Jaws on sale or something. So we got the Garou 2 sprites kind of surfaced this week. Got a look at what that game's characters might have looked like.
Yeah, all the mainstays from Mark of the Wolves, and then about 6 or 7 new characters. Kind of interesting to see what could have been. I think it was Oda who released the sprites.
Yeah, you don't think that is, you know, not intentional at all to, you know, get those out there so that people get interested in the game. And
yeah.
Then we're making another one. So
yeah.
Yeah, they said that if they do make an actual Garou 2 at this point, it will have to be in 3D like King of Fighters 14.
Yeah, but there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It used to be that we were pretty against that kind of style, because we had never seen it done right.
Yeah.
But, you know, they kind of proved that you can do that pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Be interesting.
Yeah. Good look at what, Garou 2 could have been like on the Neo Geo. And, never know. Maybe those sprites will end up in there as a classic mode or something in this. Yeah.
That'd be something.
Yep. So we got a few months ago, I remember we were talking about Oculus Rift and HTC Vive and
Revive.
Yeah, Revive, and how Oculus pushed out an update to like make that not work. It turns out that they were actually doing DRM and specifically to block Revive.
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of quietly pulled that back, because Revive just started working again. It's like, guys, maybe this whole DRM thing probably not such a good idea.
Yeah.
I can't understand the reasoning behind it, especially given that, you know, ostensibly both headsets are pretty much doing the same thing as far as, you know, the motion tracking goes. Okay, the Vive's got the hand controllers and the room tracking and whatnot, but you know, it's basically blasting images to your eyeballs.
There's probably some executive that was like, we got to get this money. I mean, this we just, I mean, don't I got to get all this money? I mean, we just can't let them do this. I mean, what about the money? And not even realizing, you know, yeah. how that's sort of like cutting off their nose to spite their face.
Yeah. So
they're not that, and that'll be how I imitate any executives from this show from now. Just go, the money. So,
yeah. So they're not doing that anymore, thankfully. It's kind of stupid for them to do it. But, okay. Now you could play Defense Grid 2 VR edition on HTC Vive if you happen to have one. So that's good. And everybody should play Defense Grid 2 VR edition, so that's something I'm very happy about.
Hey, you probably enjoy Volume when that gets on VR.
Yeah.
They've shown that it's kind of similar where it's like this tabletop version of the game.
Hmm. Yeah, that's pretty cool. Yeah, Volume just on PS4 was really great also, so. So anyways, Brandon, you got this next one.
Anybody who has been, I don't know, watching the news or looking, you know, on the internet or just listening to someone spout something about something they know nothing about on Facebook, England had sort of a
a rough week.
Yeah, they had a referendum Thursday about whether or not the UK was going to leave the European Union. And the vote ended up being like 48 points against leaving, 51 for leaving. Hmm. So even though the fact that this was actually a non-binding referendum, which... Yeah, I'm going to just say the media has done a very bad job of communicating that.
Even the UK media has done a terrible job of communicating that fact.
Yeah. Basically, the UK's economy tanked in about 24 hours.
Yeah.
And it's basically affected everyone in their economy, and as with every other part of the economy, game development especially. Has going to be some pretty severe impact on the game development in the UK. Everything, like, as far as economics go, the British pound basically plummeted by about more than 10%.
Yeah, it's the lowest it's been since 1731.
Hmm. Yeah. Those you don't know, by the way, those you don't know what happened in the 1731, it was the South Seas bubble, and it was basically a giant scam, and it almost destroyed the British economy. Hmm. So basically, there's like about 2,000 or so gaming-related companies in the UK with about 18,000 jobs. In them total. Keep in mind, they get like the UK gaming industry. Part of the reason it does so well is that it gets a lot of benefits and subsidies from the EU itself. And yeah,
they're not in the EU. They can't get those.
Not only that, but they have employees in the UK from all over the European Union.
Yeah.
So it's not just British, you know, they've also got, you know, French and German and pretty much every other country in the EU. It's again, like I said, this is a non-binding referendum, and in fact, considering the fact that the vote was so close, it is completely possible that they're probably going to have another referendum in the next few months.
Yeah, and the results of which will probably be very different.
Yeah, because...
Yeah, there were people in news reports that were like, yeah, I went out and voted for us to exit, but I didn't think it would actually do anything. Like,
what are you voting for?
And the funny part about all I can think about is people, as much as they might say about the dumb American voter, like, I actually felt a lot better seeing that. Because, like, now, of course, they you know, it's only a few people, so obviously it's anecdotal. And it's probably not indicative of the whole, but, like, just people like, yeah, I voted, and I didn't think it was going to count. Like, I mean, it was just like, well, but yet now we're exiting, and I don't think we should do that. And it was like, well, then what'd you vote for, you dumbass?
Well, okay, technically they're kind of correct because, like I said, it's a non-binding referendum. It was mostly just made to gauge what the overall feeling of the UK's voting people were thinking on part of that particular issue. But once they realized that basically that the way that they had thought, because the thing you have to understand is in the UK, nobody thought that this was going to pass. Especially after Labour MP Joe Cox was actually assassinated by a Britain First member named Thomas Mayer. But shock of shocks, it actually won by a couple of points.
Yeah.
So I got some quotes here. It is no exaggeration to say that most of the UK's laws and regulations are affected to some smaller or greater degree by the EU, says attorney Jasper Purwell and Partners. Let's see. There's also the fact that if people who work in the video game, because of the subsidies, they also get tax breaks. And because you have to remember, those tax breaks are sort of one of the reasons why the gaming development in the UK has been able to grow so fast over the years. But if the EU, if the Britain cuts itself off from the EU, that means all those tax breaks and those subsidies and all those, you know, all those handouts dry up completely.
Yeah.
And keep in mind, you know, taxes in the UK are obviously a lot higher than they are over here in the U.S. Granted, it goes to stuff that's, you know, actually important, like National Health Service. But, like, okay, we got a let's see, we got this from Mode 7. According to Mode 7 co-owner Paul Kildiff Taylor, it's unclear whether EU-related tax breaks would need to be reapproved. There's also the concern, though he cautions one that is purely speculative right now, about how an economic free-for-all and austerity measures would impact tax breaks. Tax breaks are a huge help in running Mode 7 currently. It would make things difficult for us in the future if they were to be repealed. Like I said, this is non-binding. It means nothing, but just the very speculation of it, just the idea that there were enough people in the UK who were actually willing to entertain the idea of leaving the European Union has not affected them in a good way.
No.
I mean, I was going to say, I don't know that it doesn't mean anything since, you know, their currency rate and what it's worth just, you know, hit the, you know, the floor and then went through it. I think really what I've read a lot about this, and I've been following it since it came out. The core reason this issue is happening is because part of the EU has to deal with immigration, and with the issues that we're seeing with terrorism and everything else like that, a lot of these countries don't want to have open borders with countries that they feel harbor people that could also be terrorists. Like one of the big things for a lot of these countries that they're worried about is the fact that Turkey wants to join the European Union. And if Turkey can join the European Union, then some of these people that they consider radicalized that are from that country could basically have free reign to come into different countries in Europe. And so that's the backbone of why this is happening. So what these people are really doing is acting out of fear, and it's causing economic chaos because, like, the pound dropping that low is a huge deal. And then, like, to Brandon's point, there are all kinds of multinational corporations that are based out of Britain that do depend on those tax breaks, and those tax breaks might not exist if another vote like this happens. And then, you know, people are still like, we are afraid of this. and we'll take the economic impact of it. And, you know, Europe is a different place compared to here. It's, you know, essentially for a lot of them, moving from country to country would be like moving from state to state in the United States.
Yeah.
Or from province to province, like where Phil is in our great northern neighbor. So, you know, a lot of that stuff for these guys is also is put on fear, but their economy is a lot more fragile because of how much smaller it is. And so this kind of stuff, game-wise especially, there's a whole lot of different issues that can get presented too, because one of the things for some people is if they remove themselves from the European Union, their ability to get access to certain games could change. The type of import taxes they would have to pay on stuff could change. And it could really kind of put gaming as far as something people could do monetarily sort of out of their reach. And I've read some sort of like kind of like naysayers saying that this could be the kind of thing that brings piracy back in a big way, because if these people don't have access to these games at a decent price, they're just going to steal them.
Yeah,
they were already having problems with that, where retailers were basically trying to undermine publishers constantly, just put their games on sale for like 33% off at launch.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, and you can also look at the exchange rate stuff that happens with Steam, like where people are buying Russian CD keys because they're universal, and they're doing that to save money. Mm-hmm. And that's something else you could see, but you can see that happening in the European market.
Yeah. The one good thing about it is that because of the pound dropping so quickly, basically the Steam sale comes at a good time because all their stuff is paid in U.S. money. So they get basically a boost out of whatever sales they're getting this week.
Yeah.
Which
is
weird. Yeah.
It's like even though now milk has tripled in price, you can get them games cheap though, baby.
Yeah. Hey, priorities.
Yeah. I just, before we go move on to the next topic, I wanted to point something out about Brexit that I did during the Let's Weekend, which is that again, the UK operates under a parliamentary system. And unlike in the U.S., where the issues, when they're voted on in Houses of Congress, almost always tend to go almost directly down the party line, in the U.K., the issue of the Brexit was actually different, because there were quite a few Tories, you know, Conservative Party members who were for staying in the European Union. And there was a lot of lefties, and especially, you know, Labour Party members who were for leaving the European Union.
Yeah, it's just kind of a mix of everybody.
Yeah. And honestly enough, there's actually some good arguments from the left, some good criticisms of the EU. But part of the biggest problem is that the far right in the UK was basically able to control the media presence of this issue.
Yeah.
So, you know, just throw that out there. It doesn't quite work the way it does in the U.S.
Yeah. But, yeah, it should be something for Americans to pay attention to, given that you're in an election cycle right now.
Yeah. So, and by the way, the Brexit wasn't just something that necessarily just affected the U.K. too. The Dow Jones plummeted by about 300 points.
Yeah.
That very morning. So,
yep.
You know, it affected the entire world economy.
All right. Speaking of gray market, Tiny Build and G2A have been going at it for the past couple of weeks. Chris, you put this on there. You want to fill us in?
Yeah, so this is the same sort of story we hear fairly often of these gray market sites that are essentially getting their codes. Sometimes they get them from the developer publisher directly. Other times they get them from places like Humble Bundle or any of these other number sites that are similar, where they sell their codes for dirt cheap. These companies come in and say, hey, we're going to buy up all these and sell them for a buck or two more. Skim off some profit off the top of that. And so G2A is the site that's the platform is being hammered right now, which is a site that's kind of like eBay in that it allows people to come and sell their codes to others. And this company called Tiny Build, who publishes Some actually some notable games like Party Hard, Speedrunners, No Time to Explain, Lovely Planet, some others like that. And they've talked about how they've seen a ton of their codes being sold on this site. They talked to G2A to try and figure out what's going on, because they were thinking about sort of doing partnerships with them in some way. But essentially, on their own site, tinybuild.com, they have an article here sort of talking about how they have sold about $200,000 worth of codes on G2A for three of their games, mainly Punch Club, Party Hard, and Speedrunners. And it's like upwards of about 25,000 or so codes. And the problem is, when they look at their retail pricing that they generally sell this codes for, it's about $450,000. So essentially, these people are getting these codes from other places, selling it on the site, and they're losing a ton of money, potentially. That's part of it. The other part is that G2A, being like eBay, but in complete contrast to eBay, they don't ask for verification of ID or anything like that up front from sellers. So whereas on eBay, they kind of say, hey, you're not a scumbag with a stolen credit card or bank accounts or whatever. People are allowed to just sell there first, and then they come in and say, hey, show us proof afterwards. It's like, the other part of this is also like chargebacks. You see lots of like Russian and other countries sort of scammers that steal credit cards, go to these sorts of sites, buy the codes. Then the people that actually own the cards do chargebacks because they never actually bought it. And so then the original people also get fees from those chargebacks. So not only out their code, they're out their pay, now they're also out a fee. And now they got lost a game because there's a code that somebody else has gotten for free, and they're free to sell it on G2A, sites like that, essentially like a money laundering kind of thing. Like, this code's completely untraceable for the most part. The devs know the codes.
Starts being gray market and just goes straight into black market.
Yeah, so there, it's been this whole war. Game Informer has some pretty good articles up trying to detail the whole thing. It's kind of a lot of stuff. Even the article on Tiny Build's own thing has like four updates on it, as they're like adding more stuff and reacting to press releases that G2A is releasing, trying to discredit them, all that sort of stuff. G2A has even gone to the point like, oh, they want to invite all developers and publishers experiencing problems with chargebacks to use their G2A.pay payment solutions for their stores, where it's like, yeah, if they're having problems with your service, they're not going to sit here and invest more into your service.
Yeah, that doesn't work.
It's kind of ballsy.
Yeah.
To be like, wow, you're getting screwed, you know, basically by us. Yeah. Why don't you pay us and you might not get screwed as bad? Wow.
Yeah. But in the same sense, G2A is like, oh yeah, but most of our, say more than 99.5% of their purchases are fully positive. Everything's all good. And it's like, there's that 0.5%. If you're selling millions and millions of codes, that's still
a lot of people.
Tens of thousands of potentially stolen codes that are going through your sites, and you guys are just trying to sweep it under the rug.
Yeah.
All that sort of stuff. And it's a crazy story.
Yeah.
And it's something that people have been going on as indie developers are trying to expand their business and trying to hopefully get a lot of legit business. I just have these companies come in that buy up their codes on Humble, say, hey, we're going to sell this code for $3 now instead of the $1 we paid for yours.
Yeah.
That's sort of thing that starts
to... Well, hang on. Let me ask you a question.
What's that?
What's wrong with that? If they bought a code for a certain amount and then they resell it, what's wrong with that?
That's what gray market is. It's like, it's technically legal, but it's incredibly shady.
How? No, that's they not have, shady. It, no, wait, hold on.
That's how free market works.
That's free market. That's agree. Not shady at all.
That's businesses that are setting up their, instead of working with the developer themselves. They're buying stuff from other people.
But they're buying it if they do it from a humble bundle, or they do it if they buy a key from somebody that already owns the key. I don't understand how that's a gray area, because I can buy a game today, and if I sell it to someone,
you're not a full publisher platform that's selling codes to the public. You're a
right, but even if I was,
you're buying tens of thousands of codes that way and then doing it, then you're going on a whole different thing. It's potentially, you know, short selling what these companies can actually make from their own legit codes to the consumers.
That means that the company shouldn't have sold those things for a dollar if I can get three for them.
Like, I mean, then at that point we get rid of Humble Bundle and say, well, these people ruined it for you guys. Too bad.
But here's the thing then it needs to be, what is the alternative here? Is that people can't sell codes that they own? If there's a company out there that knows that there's a market out there that they can buy this stuff off of and then turn around and resell it, and that's kind of just how free markets work. Unless they want to make, I mean, it's not like you can just make a code like bind on pickup. Like, well, here it is. It's only going to work for you and your IP address or something like that. Like, I get that some developers might not like that, but that doesn't mean that it's wrong. They're literally providing some sort of service to sell something to somebody else.
Like, well, we're talking about the specific kind of people that use stolen credit cards to buy these games. So right, developers get no money in the end.
Get
lost these fees and then goes to these other sites. I know, we're talking about this specific one where it's these stolen credit cards that are the issue. They're essentially leaving these developers without their game, without their money, and on the end they lose money in the process, losing their copies of the keys, going through sites like G2A that end up costing them a lot of money, potentially.
Well, then how come people that are able to sell keys, like Steam or something else like that, why aren't they taking the hit then? If they're the marketplace...
Steam is all their own licenses. It's all internal. They can just generate licenses at will. So when you trade your code to somebody else, essentially, nothing's really lost. There's no point where Steam loses track of this game.
So how do these other people lose track of this? Who's generating codes?
Because it becomes a code and goes completely outside of the system, then there's track that except for just deactivating the code. And when you do that, it's legit people potentially that are losing it. And that's just where it gets real shitty.
But where does the code come from?
Comes from the developer who generates it from Steam.
Well, then maybe they should do other business through Steam.
Yeah, most of them do. But
spreading out your business as well as growing.
I'm sorry. This is just something I haven't read about, and it just, from everything that's being presented, it almost reminds me of the used game conundrum. Like, well, how dare they sell something that I made? And it's like, fuck that. But I can understand, like, stolen credit cards, but you deal with that at retail too.
It's sort of like if people ripped off the stores that were selling these games, went to GameStop, tried to trade them in, and they come in with 10 sealed copies of a game. Most of those stores are like, okay, we're not going to take your stuff because there's chances you stole this or ripped it off of somebody.
Yeah,
chance of doing that with codes, because that's the same as a new game. There's no way to tell that this is a code that's been ripped off unless you somehow work with all the potential partners that went through and tried track it. No developer or publisher is really going to go that far unless they're pretty sure that they have this whole list of codes. They're pretty sure all of these got compromised in some way. They would deactivate all of them and potentially fuck over all the people that bought those codes legitimately through shady means. Like, they're legit customers, the people that got them through shady means. That's sort of where all this is through these sort of sites. Just they say, hey, come here, sell your codes. You don't have to prove to us that you're legit, you know, a real person or a real business or anything. We're just going to take little bit of commission off of it, and we're not going to pay attention unless somebody tells us we should pay attention to you.
So where is this company located?
G2A?
Yeah.
I think they have three different headquarters across Europe.
Yeah.
I believe that's what I read.
I'm trying to get in here.
Yeah, it's a real deep thing that it's hard to really try to get across quickly. Because it's something that developers have had problems with, just being real shady. Because like even small indies, like just sending out review codes, there are lots of people that send out saying, hey, I've got a YouTube channel, send me a code. And technically, they're not even attached to a code. It's that sort of thing where just trying to get these codes out to legit people, sell them to, you know, legit customers, all that sort of stuff is incredibly hard. It's sort of a uphill fight they constantly have to fight if they care about making all the money they potentially can without screwing anybody over in the process.
Yeah. Well, it's two things I wanted to get in here.
Yeah.
Because, you know, first of all, G2A really needs to do something about their management of this. I mean, you know, stolen credit cards, all that kind of shit. You have to have some sort of user verification if you're going to sell on a service. That's just common business practice.
Yeah.
There are loopholes that are big enough to drive a truck through.
Yeah. So, you know, that's
truck full of stolen codes.
Yeah.
They almost seem like the sort of like the internet version of like a chop shop.
Yeah.
That's kind of the idea.
They basically buy anything, whether it can be legit or it can be stolen property, and then they sell it back at a profit.
Yeah. But the other thing about it's like these codes coming from Humboldt, one of the things that I think drives people crazy and about that is it's kind of fundamentally like stripping away what the spirit of Humble Bundle is supposed to be.
Yeah.
So it's like, yeah.
It's treating them as just
a cheap way of getting codes where it's like, you know, you're doing this because, you know, you want to make a donation to charity, but you like to have something in return maybe or whatever, something like that. Or you want to give all the money to the developers and something like that. And, you know, if people just take those codes and then resell it at a profit, it just kind of feels sleazy.
Yeah, that's pretty much the thing all charities have to deal with.
Yeah.
Starting a deal. I mean, that's just capitalism, bro.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why Humble Bundle, like when they do Steam codes now, they do it through Steam Link.
Yeah.
You have to understand, if there is some loophole that can be exploited by some skeezy person to make a lot of money, it will happen.
Yeah. Yeah, G2A operates out of Poland, Hong Kong, and London.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I was asking, because I was sitting here trying to figure out, like, okay, so what's stopping them from doing it the way that, like, Steam GIF works or anything else like that? I agree with you on the whole premise of, like, a, you know, the Humble Bundle in the first place is charity or given to developers or whatever, and I get that, but then, like, And you're absolutely right. I mean, there should be verification for that kind of thing as well. But yeah. I also don't – like, while this may be a gray area, if somebody is – I think you also have to look at the people that are involved in this in the first place. Like, if you're going out – if you yourself are going out and buying Humble Bundles with the intention of reselling the code, you're also an asshole.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's what, something else. Like, you know, I participate in different forums that have, like, buy, sell, and trade threads. And you will see on those threads somebody selling, like, Humble Bundle keys. But they'll be selling them for, like, a dollar. It won't be, like, let me get, you know, whatever. And it's mainly – and it's usually people that are like, I already own this. So I'm either going to give it away or at least maybe somebody – you know, somebody can get a hold of it that doesn't have this. And that makes sense to me. But at the same time, like, I'm sitting here thinking, like, there has to be a better way to distribute these codes where they can't be exploited without it turning into, well, yeah, you have this code and then therefore you can't sell it at all. I think that's kind of shitty.
Yeah, it's kind of
that's all I was trying to get across.
Yeah, it's kind of the down point of having, like, this whole free market model on PC where there are various places you can get these codes from. But the
see, I don't see that downside, as a downside though. I feel like that means that the PC market actually operates the way the rest of the world does.
Yeah, well, the downside is that not all of them are legit. That's
right, but at the same time, people can go into. I mean, I had somebody clone my credit card and go try to buy gift cards at CVS. Yeah, like yeah. The difference was is that my credit card provided the protection to decline that. So, you know, something else that I can think that I'm sitting here just thinking about this is that there has to be better systems in place that can catch this kind of fraud, because people do this shit on a global scale. It's not like this stuff isn't in place to help prevent this stuff. It really is. Where do these companies come in where they're actually going to protect the people that are trying to sell this stuff?
Yeah, on G2A, it's generally they come in after they're trying to sell this, shut down the account, and say, hey, provide us proof. Whereas if they're the sketchy people they think they are, they've already abandoned it, maybe tried to make another account or do something else with the code they know will work. It's that sort of thing where they're doing it way after the fact, where they should be doing it up front, saying, you know, we want proof that you're not just stealing all this stuff. And they're not doing it. That's why TinyBuild has a problem with them, because they see them selling $200,000 worth of codes. They're not getting the money. And they're left out with, you know, 25,000 copies of the game that they could have potentially sold at some sort of cost. They would have gotten money for it. And this ends up costing some developers to actually have to shut down. That's sort of the sad part of it, because, you know, while you're saying, you know, Humble Bundle and all these other sites are actually, you know, great to have, even if there's a few bad apples, sometimes it goes real bad for some of these companies that are trying to just make it legitimate as much as they can.
I mean, I'm sympathetic to that, but then again, I have a huge problem, and let me just tell you where my thought process is coming from. I've always had a huge problem, and it's something that has come about in the last few years, especially the last 6 or 7, with this idea that the video game industry thinks that it can operate completely different than the rest of the world does in regards to the economy and in regards to the way that consumer rights work and everything else like that, and it bothers me tremendously. Like, I don't want to see anybody go out of business or anything else like that. But if these keys were bought, whether they're legitimate or not, you know, they were bought somehow. There has to be protections for those people. And, yeah, we can bring up the whole thing about, like, well, bad eggs and this and that. But there's absolutely no reason that the PC market or anything like it should have a different set of rules than anything else in the world economy. There's just no reason behind it. It sucks if people go bankrupt. It sucks if a company puts something out there and they got taken advantage of, and then that puts them out of business. But that doesn't mean that everyone else or the ability to sell these things or sell anything that you own, whether it's digital or not, should be compromised because one company is going to go out of business because some dickhead got a stolen credit card. Like that's and we saw that debate happen all of last generation, where the video game industry seemed to think that it should operate differently. We saw shit like Project $10. We saw people like Cliffy B and everybody else demonizing people that bought used games. And it wasn't even the used game portion. It's that they were demonizing people because they felt they had a right to own the things that they bought. And when I look at something like Humble Bundle, okay, if you're giving these keys away for a dollar, if your business is so fragile that if somebody doing something fraudulent like buying, you know, a couple thousand keys and then those are on stolen credit cards and then that screws you over, you've got to change your business model. The market shouldn't change because you did something stupid. Like,
they're not necessarily equating digital with used games in this sense. Because used games are actual physical things that exist.
That's not the equation. No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm talking about the ability for someone to own the thing that they bought. If I get a Humble Bundle, whatever, right, and then I have 5 keys and I only use 2, that stuff, the key still technically belongs to me, and I can sell it to whoever the hell I want. It just sucks that there's a site out there that is basically taking all of this stuff and then reselling it. That sucks, but that's also how the economy works. That's how the world economy works.
To a degree, because with like used games, those are all legit copies. There's no way you can have those things circulating.
But the code was generated one way or another. People can buy a legit copy of a game with a stolen credit card.
Yeah, so, these people are specifically going after those stolen credit card codes and trying to find some way to work with these people like G2A, these other sites, sort of saying, hey, is there any way we can prevent these scumbags from doing business on your site so that we can get better control over these ill-gotten codes?
Yeah, I imagine instead that probably won't happen because it sounds like this site is making their money off of those scumbags.
Yeah, and they're putting out press release saying, yeah, fuck off.
Yeah, so...
It's one of those things, it's... Until these sorts of sites stop being supported by people, which seems like it's probably not going to happen, these indie publishers and developers are going to constantly have to be careful with who they're doing business with.
Yeah.
And sort of try to stay two steps ahead of everything that's going on. And that's really tough for some of these companies. Yeah. Especially when you, like I said earlier, like review codes is even incredibly hard. When you got people trying to say they work at Giant Bomb and get codes, and those people go to Giant Bomb like, wait, this person doesn't really work for you, right? Like, no, go fuck those people in the ass.
Yeah. So. It sucks, but yeah, we're going to have to move on from that because we're running a bit long here. So, quick note from BioWare. It looks like they're going to be doing a series of novels tying the old story arc to the new one.
Yeah, basically what they're going to do is they're trying to create a series of books that is sort of meant to... Sort of, because the thing about the story about Mass Effect Andromeda is that it's supposed to take place a couple hundred years after the end of Mass Effect 3.
Right.
And the book's primary purpose is they're trying to sort of fill in the gap between the two, because obviously a couple hundred years is
a big gap to leave hanging.
Also, keep in mind that Mass Effect Andromeda, this particular game, and probably series, because I kind of guess they're going to keep this particular part of the franchise going, takes place in a completely different part of space. So, you know, it's in the Andromeda system. It's way out of the, you know, where the other games took place in.
Yeah, I believe the trailer said that humans wanted to find a new place, new home, and so they went to the Andromeda Galaxy.
Yeah. Apparently, as the trailer showed, they're still going to come to contact with places like the Citadel and all that stuff, because you kind of have to.
Yeah, it's Citadel too.
Yeah. Also, the reason I'm bringing this is because the first book, by the way, which comes out a month after next, in August, is being written by N.K. Jemisin, who is maybe one of my favorite writers in the speculative fiction genre. She's a big seller. She's also the woman that managed to get Vox Day kicked out of the Science Fiction Writers of America. So there's also that. So she's kind of my personal hero.
Yeah.
So Drew Karpchin's not doing it. Does he even work for BioWare anymore?
I think he left.
He went independent, but he's actually been doing some work for them on the Old Republic. So it's completely possible that Drew Karpyshyn will actually be getting, you know, he might get contracted to do one of these books.
I think it's more because he's a big extended universe author.
Well, yeah,
I've read a few of his on Star Wars stuff.
He's also
wrote Mass Effect.
Mass Effect 1 and 2, actually. Yeah. He's one of the main universe guys for it. He also did a good chunk of work on Knights of the Old Republic as well.
But, yeah, he's a pretty decent writer, actually, as far as like any of those kind of like tie-ins. Usually most of the stuff's, you know, kind of poorly written.
He's done a lot of really good Star Wars. He's done a lot of really good Star Wars stuff. He's also he's done original stuff too. He's got what's known as the Chaosborn trilogy, which recently finished, which I actually highly recommend. It's pretty good. I actually hope he kind of gets in on this. If not, I hope they get some good writers and not William Dietz, that abomination of a book he released around Mass Effect 3's time. It's just, I would rather not think about that.
Yeah. Well, seems like they're off to a good start at least. So.
Yeah, these people have a bunch of Resident Evil books, 7 of them coming. Oy. So if you want your Resident Evil fiction expanded on, there you go.
Oh, by the way, the they're going to be putting out 4 books, and apparently the last one is going to be written by Mark Walters himself. So, you know, we'll see how it goes.
Yeah.
Of course, the other 3 I don't think are coming out until after the game is released. So,
yeah. So, see how that goes.
I got 3
Dishonored. It's going to be interesting to see what they do because of how kind of large Mass Effect was in terms of its scope and the
Mass Effect. The Mass Effect drama is going to be even bigger.
Well, it's one of those things that, like, I wonder too. Like, I don't know if you guys have noticed this. Like, just to switch gears for just a second. Like, you look at like movies now. Especially if you look at anything where there's like some sort of continuity between films, it's always about like the bigger. I mean, we see that in games too. Like, I wonder if they would ever take an approach at some point to really just kind of make a smaller story. I think that would be just as interesting as this thing's going to kill the galaxy, you know. Even focusing on just a few planets, maybe those planets are getting killed as opposed to, you know, giant bugs destroying the universe.
Giant squid aliens slowly devouring the universe. Yeah. Because that's basically what the Reapers turned out to be.
Yeah. So, yeah. Keep an eye out for that.
Yeah. And now for the big story of the week.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll probably have to cut a couple of these other ones because we are running a bit.
But we'll just go over them fairly quickly.
Yeah, but we can't, like, not talk about Keiji Inafune's meltdown this week. Mighty No. 9 launched to issues.
Yeah, and fairly middling reviews as well.
Yeah. So this game is out, and Keiji Inafune was doing a live stream, and he had some interesting things to say during that live stream.
At least Ben Judd had to say for him.
You never want to hear a developer saying it's better than nothing. That's not confidence inspiring in the least.
No. Especially when it was kickstarted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Not only kickstarted, but was one of, at that point, the biggest funded Kickstarter in history.
Yeah. Until Bloodstained came around.
Yeah.
Dude, I feel bad for Inafune.
I actually do, too. I definitely believe he got in way over his head.
Yeah.
Yeah, when you're releasing 10 SKUs for a game, you've gone a little bit overboard.
Yeah, I think that's what screwed them. I think it was they should have just, I mean, dude, look at, now, of course, it's obviously a different scope and different scale, but I mean, you know, Axiom Verge was one guy. You know, didn't get released on 10 systems. Look at the stuff that the guys from Supergiant Games are doing. They really release on 1 or 2 systems and then do the stuff later. And that's a whole team. Like, I ended up reading an interview where one of the things that they talked about was, a big point for them that really kind of moved them forward was that they own the Mighty No. 9 IP. And so that was a really big deal for them to make sure they diversified, that they got, you know, anime deals and all this other stuff to sort of cash in on it, because, I mean, look at the hype behind it, right? Like, this is supposed to be the next Mega Man. Capcom's not doing the next Mega Man, so here's the guy that did it. You know, this is something you should stand behind. And then to just kind of have – the funny part about it is that it's kind of like everything that Mega Man's not. And the controls are imprecise. The game's not fun. Like, Mega Man is sort of like, at least for me, was built on the fact that you're moving forward and you're using your skills to continue to move forward, whereas even just the basic dash system really only seems to work like once or twice, depending on where you are. And then the rest of the time, actually getting through the game is difficult. And the big reason I feel bad for him, too, is this is the same guy that really has just kind of been shitting on the Japanese game industry for years about how much it needs to change and everything. And so I know there are people out there that just could not wait for him to fail. and this is going to be like red meat to them. And I feel bad because I don't think he's a bad game developer. I think he got caught up in the same thing that we see all of these game developers get caught up in, is that, you know, he thought too big and they didn't scale it down. And, you know, after they thought everything they did, after they concepted everything, after they did, you know, all the research, they still had to deliver a game. I mean, Halo 2 went through that, if you guys recall. Halo 2, you know, the game that they had was completely different than the demo that they had at E3. They even said, okay, after E3, guys, we actually need to produce a game now. Like, you know, that kind of thing where it's just like, so that's one of the reasons I feel bad for him, because there was a ton of people probably wanting him to fail, and they probably had a great concept and they didn't know how to massage that into a game. And I that makes me think about the delays that happened. I don't think they were about connectivity. I think it's because the game didn't work.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, I saw a bunch of stories this week of people finally realizing that Keiji Inafune didn't actually create the Mega Man series.
Yeah, that's an important
thing. He was just a concept artist on the first game.
He just, the first and second. He didn't, he actually is, it's just what happened is that after the original creator left to go form his own company, he was kind of just given the role for the next few games. So he kind of
became the guy that had, he was a guy that had been there the longest, so it became his.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but see, you have to remember the original Mega Man and a lot of the sprite characters were not from him. They were actually from Akira Akamatsu, I think is his name. He's the guy who actually created Mega Man and the whole concept behind it. So,
yeah, which is the ripoff of Astro Boy. So,
yeah.
Only,
you know, Mega Man actually seems to wear clothes.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, my trip to Best Buy actually pointed out one big flaw with this game's name. Is that guess what game is sitting next to it on store shelves alphabetically? Mm. Mega Man Legacy Collection.
Whoops.
So yeah, you don't want to be compared to it.
But you're sitting right next to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
tough. And Sega of America had something to say about this stuff too, didn't they?
Yeah, they were just kind of...
They were Sega of America.
Yeah, kind of a snarky tweet.
Congrats on the launch. It's better than nothing.
Yeah.
Which is such a dickhead thing to do because you're Sega of America. Yeah. Like,
this from the company that hasn't released a good Sonic game in, like, years, you know.
Speaking of Sonic games.
Yeah, that's a pretty good segue here. Apparently, Sega is actually working on a new one.
Sonic Team themselves, right?
Sonic Team, yeah.
Not coming from Yosuka.
Yeah. It's going to be a completely new Sonic game.
I'm going to cross my fingers.
Yeah. Well, we're likely going to hear about it next month at Comic-Con, where Danrip's going to be at that event. So, yeah, we'll probably have some first-hand.
I wonder why they're waiting for Comic-Con.
Because that's also when they're doing their anniversary celebration.
Oh, right.
Yeah, it's more of a party that just coincides with it.
Yeah. So we'll get some more info on that as time goes by.
Yeah, right. They even have a big Humble Bundle thing for Sonic.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like $10, you get all of the Sonic games, probably.
Yeah.
It says more games coming soon. I was like, that's probably going to be the other Sonic games that are in there. And there are
other Genesis ones that I'm missing. That might be a good way for me to actually get them, complete my collection on Steam.
You pay $35, you get a shirt.
Yeah. Yeah, might actually do that.
And maybe, you know, hopefully the next Sonic game won't be a glitchy mess.
Yeah.
Because if it is, you know that, you know, Game Grumps is going to do a whole thing on it.
Yeah.
They're going to find every single glitch there is and mock the hell out of Sega for doing it. Also, Aaron Hansen will die a lot.
Yeah, because he's not very good at games.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So, you know, we got a couple of big name companies who are kind of enthused about the NX. CD Projekt is kind of happy with how the NX is going, and so is Warner Brothers, apparently.
Those are important endorsements.
Yes, they are.
Yeah. Well, I don't know how important Warner Brothers is, because I think any new platform that shows up, they're on it.
Yeah. Because they're Warner Brothers.
Yeah. So
CD Projekt on
this isn't just a declaration of support. This is them saying that they've seen the system and they like it.
Yeah.
That's very different.
Honestly, yeah. CD Projekt's endorsement means more to me because they're...
People said the same thing about the Wii U, though.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Everybody was excited about that, and look what happened.
Yeah.
Except for CD Projekt.
Yeah, well, they weren't excited. Right. It's like, Witcher 3 on the Wii? No, that's not going to happen.
But if CD Projekt, you know, if they actually like it, and, you know, that holds weight to me because... CD Projekt as a company is pretty much, as far as, you know, not just, you know, releasing quality products, but as far as ethics go.
Yeah.
Also,
they're also the kind of company that will take a technology, a platform, and just push it to have as far as it can go.
Yeah.
So if they're looking at the NX and thinking, yeah, we could probably work with this, that kind of says something.
Yeah.
Speaking of the, and I know it's kind of ahead in the notes, but we might as well go ahead and bring it up. Breath of the Wild, the new Zelda game, is got a U.S. trademark, and what that trademark says in it actually seems to suggest something pretty interesting.
Yes.
Apparently, it seems to suggest that the Nintendo NX may be cartridge-based.
Yeah, and that's not a problem.
Because well, you have to, you know, it actually makes me think, would a cartridge is in this day and age, well, I mean, technically, obviously, the Nintendo, the 3DS is technically cartridge-based, isn't it?
Yeah, it's an SD card, basically.
Yeah. So if they could do that with the graphical power needed for an actual console, would that actually be, are cartridges actually more economically feasible than discs?
No, they're going to be a little bit more expensive, but not so much.
Not prohibitively.
Prohibitively. And I think the advantages of the fact that, you know, a cartridge or SD or whatever they're gonna put it on has no moving parts. It's not subject to getting scratched.
So the only thing you'd have to worry about is dust getting into it.
Yeah, I mean, you just clean the contacts and, you know, those are exposed anyway, so it's not hard to. And the other advantage is speed.
Yeah.
You know.
You don't have to wait for shit to load.
Yeah. Whereas, you know, you've experienced this on the Xbox One. You put a disc in and then you come back the next day after to play it.
I can't tell you how many times I've come home at night from GameStop ready to play Xbox One game, new Xbox One game. I'm like, yeah, I got Overwatch. Time to... Oh, right, Xbox One. Well, see you tomorrow morning, Overwatch.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, really, I have no issue with this whatsoever. I think, you know, in this day and age, we're at a point where solid-state media is cheap enough and reliable enough that it makes sense to go back to it. We're not at the point of ROMs anymore where it was really expensive to produce them because you had to put so many of them on a cartridge to do anything with it. And in this case, you know, you're working with a system that's scalable. And basically means that a game can be as big as it needs to be. It doesn't have to worry about, you know, storage constraints. Just make the game as big as you want it. And if it's 256 gigabytes, well, we can supply that. No problem.
All right. That's good, because I was actually wondering about that, the fact that they were going back to cartridge-based media.
Yeah.
And generally speaking, the more moving parts that you can strip out of a console, the better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Also keep in mind that if the rumors of the NX being this sort of hybrid system are true.
Although I think those are starting to fizzle out.
Yeah, probably. But, you know, if they were true, then an optical... drive on a portable device, that doesn't make much sense. I mean, the PSP works so well.
But what's got me worried is sort of the way consumers may perceive this, because, you know, because the Nintendo system will, instead of the other systems, will be running primarily through cartridge-based, will that make them think that it's somehow primitive compared to the other two?
I don't think so. I think people are used to digital distribution enough that it doesn't really matter to them anymore. It's just how you get the bits onto the system.
Okay.
So I don't think it's going to be that big of an issue, and I think the advantages are going to outweigh the cons. You know, a game might be a little bit more expensive, but I kind of doubt it with the...
Well, let's see. How up until fairly recently, I think, like, the average Nintendo game up until fairly recently was usually, like, 10 or something, or at most, like, $10 less than, you know, what you would get at an Xbox, or like a Microsoft or a Sony system.
Yeah.
Obviously, the Wii U put an end to that pretty quickly.
Yeah.
But if it's a cartridge-based, which I think are, you know, I'm not sure. We're going to have to see.
Yeah. I know that, you know, stamping discs is very, very cheap. It's just, it's a few pennies per disc. Uh-huh. So this is going to take it up to, you know, it's going to be about 50, 60 cents, maybe a bit more to actually produce that. And then the flash memory itself is going to be a bit more than that. But you're talking a couple of bucks as opposed to a few cents. It's not something that's going to kill them. And in the bulk purchasing that Nintendo can do, they can probably keep their costs down with that anyway.
Yeah.
And as I said, since it is a medium that's scalable, it's, you know, you're not pressing 25 gigs, whether you're using 4 of it. You can basically just put as much as you need to into the cartridge and not worry about it.
Right.
So... yeah, I think this is good for everybody.
All right.
Yeah.
So we're going to kind of go through these other two quickly because...
yeah, jump back. Not a whole lot to say here about Machine Games because they put out a new Quake 1 episode.
Yeah.
Okay.
Following John Carmack's steps of making a new Doom episode.
Yeah. Yeah, John Romero.
Of that. Weird, unexpected developers making mods for old games that nobody thought about in a long time.
Yeah, it does kind of make me think maybe Machine Games is probably going to be doing the next Quake single-player game.
Yeah.
Which I wouldn't have a problem with.
Well, if you played, you know, Wolfenstein New Order, you know they can make one hell of a... of a single-player shooter.
So. Yeah. So, yeah. If you want a kind of taste of that, you can download that new episode and...
probably get Quake cheap on Steam now.
Yeah, or on GOG. I think it's on GOG.
Yeah, it's on GOG.
Sale ended a couple days ago.
Yeah, it's probably cheap on
Steam. They've got, like, the Quake pack.
Yeah.
So
check that out. I'm going to.
And I guess, finally, our last story is... Ed Boon.
Yeah, he's apparently teasing a third combat pack for Mortal Kombat 10.
Great game just keeps getting bigger.
Yeah, it's also getting more expensive.
Yeah.
But, you know, we're used to Killer Instinct, so it's not really that huge of a deal.
Yeah, there's a precedent for it for sure.
Yeah. Except, you know, I didn't pay $60 for Killer Instinct when I bought it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Also, he's going to be, there's probably going to be some Injustice 2 guest characters.
Yeah, which, you know, I don't really have that big of an issue with. You know, I think MK versus DC Universe was a pretty cool concept with a flawed execution.
Yeah.
So, you know, you get NetherRealm now.
Yeah, that's because they're making.
That they have.
Yeah, that's because they're making Mortal Kombat like the previous gen.
Yeah.
Not like the current gen where they're doing straight 2D.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So. Plus, I mean, technically, you know, with Injustice, they did kind of have a Mortal Kombat crossover.
Yeah, Scorpion showed up. He was kind of different, but showed up. Yeah, I don't know if I'm willing to pay another $30 for a pack of characters, but yeah, this may
happen. We'll see what's in store.
Yeah.
It better be a hell of a pack.
Yeah. So, finally, I guess we'll get to the discussion of the week, which kind of bears on the Inafune story from earlier on. Has the Mighty No. 9 debacle kind of soured you on the crowdfunding games?
I would say no. Mainly just crowdfunding games where it seems like they're not prepared to do what they're actually promising.
Yeah. See, it's like
promising you know, 10 SKUs and all these new modes, online multiplayer at launch, like, stay away from those sorts of games.
Yeah. Like, you know, like, if you're going to do a Kickstarter, really, I would kickstart for someone who seemed to show that they know what they're doing. Like, for example, the Yuka and Laylee Kickstarter.
Yeah. That game's looking good.
Yeah. See, because those are a lot of the old people from Rare who, you know, worked on, you know, Banjo-Kazooie, Conker's Bad Fur Day. You know these guys know how to make a good collect-a-thon platformer. So.
Yeah.
Well, technically speaking, Inafune should have fit that profile.
Technically, should have, but everybody does make mistakes now and then. And I think, you know, as far as Inafune goes, this is the kind of thing that he only will do once.
He will
have had to have learned from this mistake. If he does another crowdfunding, he's going to have to, you know, set some more realistic goals.
Yeah,
because, you know, Kickstarter and Indiegogo, those are just platforms. They're not able to, like, set some sort of bar, dictate, like, quality that'll, that everybody is going to adhere to. It's like, Steam's great, but there's a lot of shitty games. That doesn't speak to problems with Steam. It's just a lot of people can get onto Steam. Doesn't matter whether they're good or not.
Yeah.
That's sort of what you want, is you want people both big and small, good and bad, to at least get a shot at potentially making the good game that they think they can.
Yeah. So, yeah, for me, it's all about managing expectations and, you know, having confidence in the people who you're putting your money behind.
Yeah.
It's like, recently I got my hands on the Bloodstained demo, and my confidence was validated after playing. It's like, that game
is going to be so good.
Everything we wanted.
Yeah, that game had a pretty good campaign running for it.
Yeah, it's like after Mighty No. 9, that became the most funded. And it looks like Igarashi and the team that's behind it actually do know what they're doing. So yeah, that's what I got to say there.
Yeah, don't back games expecting them to be amazing and live up to what your personal image is of what that could be. Back them because you'd like them to make the game they think is going to be great.
Right.
If it doesn't work out, well, generally you're only out $10 to $20.
Yeah.
And if you're the person that's putting in $1,000, that's where you got to really be sure you know what you're doing.
Yeah.
Wow, I'm completely different than you guys.
Hey, we all got differing opinions. So.
Yeah.
I just you know what it is? I don't like Kickstarter in a lot of ways. Just because I think it can lead to this kind of thing. I'm sort of at the point where I feel like if you're going to and just to give you some background, I used to be the kind of guy that would pre-order games, do everything else like that. I'm not that anymore, and part of that is because so many people have put out things that sucked, you know?
Yeah.
And it was one of those things, like, I'm going to wait to see the reviews. I'm going to wait to see that. And I could see for certain things, like, going, okay, well, like Bloodstained. On paper, totally makes sense to me, right? But at the same time, you know, I guess if I fancy myself as someone that looks more at the business side of this stuff. And from everything that I've seen, the majority of Kickstarters that are out there, the budget that they're going with is ridiculous, and it's not going to get the game that they're promised. And so that's been the kind of thing that's sort of taken me aback on pretty much looking at any Kickstarter there. I mean, you guys remember last year around E3 time when people were like, Shenmue 3, it's got like $3 million. The original one cost 50.
Yeah.
Okay, and that was in the 90s. All right, so...
Well, those numbers are a little bit sketchy because those potentially include both of the games and all the Saturn versions they made. That's the thing I always found crappy about the media part of it. It's like, you guys are kind of misrepresenting that number a little bit.
Well, but here's the thing. Even if they were just porting the game, ports are a fraction of what the initial development cost. And yes, like with Shenmue... they were creating something that had been created at that time. I totally understand that. But when you're talking about pure economics, like if I know I can't feed my family for less than $20, asking for four is stupid. And I'm only going to disappoint my wife and my kid and the dogs when I come home. And I go, well, you know, this ramen's better than nothing. Like, it doesn't work that way. And so when I look at a lot of these Kickstarters, particularly ones where they're talking like where stretch goals are other platforms, all I can think about is how are you not going to deliver on this? And I think that Kickstarter is definitely a great tool for smaller things. But like, let's maybe we could call Mighty No. 9 an outlier. I mean, Mighty No. 9 probably should have been a game with a much larger budget to produce what they were talking about. Yeah. But look at what happened with Broken Age. Broken Age had to be broken into two parts, and they had to ask for more money. Like it's all, okay. To put it a different way, I bought a house in January, right?
Right.
We added a screen porch to the house. My wife did. And anytime you just go with what the base price was, you're setting yourself up for failure. Like our project, what it was originally quoted as and what my wife ended up paying for it was a lot higher. And that was because shit comes up. Yeah. And I feel like that's the biggest flaw in the Kickstarter model is there's never any budget for shit comes up.
Yeah.
And like, look at Mighty No. 9 is a perfect example. How much money did they burn on those 3, 4, 5, 6 month delays trying to get the game where it needed to be? That's just more money going down the toilet, really, to kind of polish up a turd, you know? So now, and I do think there will be, you know, exceptions. Like I think Bloodstained, from everything I've seen, even just seeing it in motion, like it nails what it's supposed to have. But you know, the proof is still going to be in the pudding. It's still going to be, you know, how does it play when we get it, when it's actually working and everything else like that. And it's something as a whole about the industry that's kind of bothering me. Like I see the reason for it to exist. I see the reason for Steam Greenlight to exist. I see reasons for early access stuff to exist. But at the same time, I feel like there's more people out there that are taking advantage of that and not producing the product that they promised. And I feel like that's happening more than the other way around. And I think until those ratios get even somewhat even.
And better safeguards are implemented.
Yeah. Right. I mean, you guys saw that video of that dude who took all the – I don't even remember what it was for, what game it was for. But it wasn't for a game. It was for a 3D printer. Yeah. And it was kickstarted. And one of the – like the project lead on it took all the money that they were given for Kickstarter and bought a house. And so then like the other dude that was the main face of it ended up doing this video where he was like, look, you know, I knew what we were going to produce. And my business partner basically took all this money and he bought a house. So in order to vindicate myself and make sure that none of you guys are mad at me, here's a video. And then it switches like to them in a hotel room. And there's this really dramatic music, and the original lead of the project is asking the dude that stole the money. He's like, so let's just be clear. You took that money to and what'd you do with it? And the guy's like, I bought a house, and I shouldn't have done that. And it's just like
– Yeah.
And now, of course, you know, you don't want to paint with a broad brush. But, I mean, we've seen all of these Kickstarters – that have happened with legit people. Like Neil Stevenson did a Kickstarter for a sword fighting game and nothing came out. And it was just like, yeah, sorry, the money's gone. Yeah. And like, I think the bottom line thing to take away if you're going to Kickstarter anything is be willing to part with the amount of money that you're not going to be mad if the product doesn't deliver.
Yeah.
And I'm just not that kind of person anymore. Mm-hmm. If it was, you know, 15 years ago where I didn't have the other responsibilities that I have, I'd probably kickstart a lot of things, but I'm at the point in my life where if I'm going to pay you for something, you're going to give me something, and it's going to be something that I want, as opposed to, well, it's better than nothing.
Yep.
Yeah, I think for people like you that want more of a finished product, you just wait, let it come out,
exactly.
And see how that's going to go.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas, I haven't seen anything as far as a Kickstarter that has made me go, I got to get in there. Like, whatever the extras are, where I'm like, I'm all about that. Like, hook it up.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, that's perfectly fine.
Like that.
That's just the way it's always been. You just wait till the game comes out and then you buy it.
Yep.
Yeah. There are people like me and Phil and others who want to be at least part of the process of helping those games get out. Be able to say, you know, Super Hot sounds cool. I want to put $15 into that, get that when it comes out, and just see how it develops. Because I'm fascinated by the development process, especially for these indie games where you get these updates. And it's like, well, we decided to throw out this and, you know, redo our UI because it's the rest of this content looks too good as we're making it. And this UI just looks like crap. It's like, well, that's awesome.
Yeah.
That's a cool thing I never thought about. Like, you had this thing made before you had the rest of it. Now the rest of it looks way better than this stupid health bar you got now.
Mm.
And it's things like that that's really cool. And as far as things like there's more failures than successes, I don't think that's true at all. I think I can show you like the list of Kickstarters as that are about to end, and you can see the vast majority of them are failing. Because there are things that nobody wants. Like one of the once it's ending in about 4 hours is a project called Create My Own Pokemon Parody Card Game. And as you expect, like nobody's funded that. It's got $11 and that might be that person's mom if put $11 in. Yeah. And it's like generally if it's funded, there are plenty of people wanting that to at least have a chance of happening. And it's
I get that. I totally get that. Like, and that's fine. Y'all want to spend your money that way? That's cool. People are allowed to spend their money however they want. I'm going to go buy some shady Russian CD keys after this is done from that website because that's how I want to spend my money. No, I'm just kidding. But like, as far as and I understand that. But like, I'm correct me if I'm wrong. Just thinking off the top of my head, I cannot think of a Kickstarted game. I think except for Shovel Knight. It was exceptional when it came out.
Super Hot.
Is that out?
It's been out for a few months. Okay. I'm trying to look on Steam has a specific also Kickstarter tag. Yeah. Wasteland 2, Freedom Planet, FTL.
FTL, yeah, that's right. FTL, yeah.
Banner Saga, Shadowrun.
Shadowrun was not very good when it came out, though.
Just, I don't know. I thought I heard really good things for those games.
Well, they improved it later, but they also cut the scope of that project. Like they were like, we're going to, the stuff that we promised you, we have to end up splitting and we're going to have to give it to you in a later game.
Okay.
That's what they did with whatever the expansion was. So, I mean, like I said, I get your point. Good. Like I understand, but it's just one of those things where like, for me, because my time is so limited, I feel like if I'm going to put my money into something, it's got to be something that I want. That I want to play and that I know is going to be good. Like I'm at the point in my life where I just don't have time to waste on experiences that are less, frankly, less than stellar.
Yeah, and you don't have to. You can just wait till they come out, see how they do.
Yeah, exactly. Like if I had spent money on, if I had kickstarted Mighty No. 9, I'd be pissed.
Yeah.
It's
like, yeah. I mean, I can count on one hand the amount of games that I have actually kickstarted because, well, you know, the vast majority of them don't really appeal to me, but there's a handful that I'll go through and look and it's like, yeah, I kind of want this to happen. So, you know, one of them was Defense Grid 2, which is a really interesting case because that one was a Kickstarter that only partially succeeded.
And then they got a publisher that helped them
be
able to do the rest.
And then they honored the Kickstarter backers for to actually get it.
Yeah, I think it's incredibly important to research the project you're looking at.
Yeah.
Make sure the people are trustworthy and have a good business plan to it.
Yeah.
It's one of the things I frequently kickstart is any of the pinball arcade licensed tables.
Yeah.
And you look at their pitches and they're like, listen, we've done these dozens and dozens of tables. We know how much this costs. We know how long it's going to take us. And so this is how much we need.
Yep.
To pay for the licensing so that we don't have to raise the prices on this table just if we were to do it all in-house.
Yeah.
It's that sort of stuff. And, you know, I can look over my stuff like Amplitude's pretty good. Cosmic Star Heroine's coming out soon, and that looks really good. Things like that. Defense Grid 2. Sports Friends was really good, things like that. It's it's just that these things are like a platform that gives people the opportunity to get this stuff out there. And it all depends on how you use it.
Yeah.
You know, because we only typically hear about Kickstarter when it fails, because who's going to write about it and say, hey, this thing actually succeeded, it's great.
Yeah.
That's just when the review comes out and people are like, oh yeah, this was also a Kickstarter.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's sort of the messaging problem is nobody's like, yay, you did everything right.
Yeah.
Well, they're not getting my money. Give me a product and I'll buy it. I'm not back in hopes and dreams.
Fair enough. So I think this is about as good a spot as any to end the show.
Yeah.
So I'm Filippo D'Anolfo.
Pat.
he was Patrick Mifflin.
I'm Brandon Perkins.
I'm Chris Sologi.
And I'm opinionated.
And remember, it's better than nothing.